Hello and welcome to Bone Up, the podcast all about bones, how we make them, why we break them, and if we fully understand them. I'm David Armstrong.
Hi, and I'm Richie Abel. And over this series, we're going to be exploring osteoporosis, bones, what we know and what we're yet to discover. And we hope you will join us on the journey.
So for anyone keen to learn more about our infrastructure of calcified collagen, this is Bone Up.
Welcome, listeners. We're back. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing very well. If you followed us on Twitter, you will have heard we had just a slight delay through life events. We have to do the things that they actually pay us to do occasionally, Richie, as well, don't we?
Unfortunately, we do, yes.
But we're back and we have several more guests lined up for very exciting interviews. And today is one of those. So have you been busy the last month or two?
Yeah, very busy. I went on a trip to visit MIT in Boston, meet some collaborators and try and get a project going, I'm excited about that. I've had the start of term here at Imperial, getting everybody going again. All the students are back, which is nice because the place gets really lively. Had a couple of new PhD students starting in the lab, looking at the effect of air pollution on bone. And hopefully, in the next few months, we'll have another PhD student starting in the lab looking at the health of ballet dancers. So if you're out there and you're interested in ballet and you want to do a PhD, get in touch.
Yeah, that's something you talked about earlier in the year, which was very interesting. And we got over the Royal Osteoporosis Society conference as well, which was great to be back for a face-to-face conference. I've certainly been busy seeing a lot of osteoporosis patients at my clinic, and then I had the great privilege, I was asked to give the annual Dairy Council of Northern Ireland scientific lecture at Ulster University, and I had the chance to not only talk about bones, which is what you imagine I would talk about, but also a bit about ancient history, about archaeology, about the development of dairy farming over the last sort of 8,000 or 9,000 years. We got to hear about what some ancient doctors and ancient historians had to say about bones. We got to look at some Renaissance art. We got to talk about 19th century politics and right up to the present day. So I really enjoyed myself immensely, Richie, I have to say, getting talking about history and bones, which are my two big areas. And I got good feedback. Everyone else seemed to enjoy it as well. And I got a lovely piece of fine china as a thank you. So that was good fun.
I saw the pictures on Twitter. It looked amazing.
Well, it was fun to do, and it seemed to get good feedback. And
was it recorded so we can all listen?
I don't know if it was recorded. I think they had the slides, but to be honest, the slides bore very little resemblance to what I actually said, because as you know, I tend to just make things up as I go along. So. But maybe that was a wasted opportunity or maybe not. But yeah, other things going on as well. I mean, I suppose to keep people up to date, we had Stuart Ralston and Kirsty on talking about a year ago now about pregnancy associated osteoporosis. So that study is up and running, and I've managed to recruit a number of patients to that. So that's exciting. In fact, I have someone else coming up just next week. So that's ongoing. And also, I mean, we had Jared Wong on earlier the year talking about Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and I've been very privileged to be asked to join a committee looking at that and looking at guidelines for adults with osteoporosis with Duchenne. So yeah, keeping myself busy, as are you, but we find time to do this podcast, which is the most exciting and important thing.
It is. To be honest with you, it's probably the most fun bit of my job right now. So listeners, we quite often put out messages on Twitter asking people what kind of topics you want to hear about. And since the day we started recording the podcast, one of the things that always comes up is bone health in young people. and the relationship between bone health and eating disorders. So that's the topic we're going to discuss today, because so many people have been asking us about it. David, how does this come up in your clinic?
Yeah, I mean, it's something we've talked about often. The perception is that osteoporosis just affects older people, but actually in a hospital setting as a specialist, I get quite a high percentage of younger people referred to the clinic. And I think that's important because osteoporosis in younger people is clearly a complex and, you know, more unusual area. I see a fair number of young people with eating disorders, predominantly young women, and I probably should see more young men because it's probably more common in young men than we recognize. I do see young people who take steroids, corticosteroids, and sometimes high doses for other conditions. And you do sometimes get young people referred up with fragility fractures and bone problems, and investigations reveal other diagnoses. So sometimes you would pick up other conditions such as osteogenesis imperfecta. We've had one or two people diagnosed with celiac disease who presented with fractures and low bone density. But every now and again, we turn up other unusual conditions. So, I mean, I would say people probably don't perceive that an osteoporosis specialist, or that most osteoporosis specialists, see a lot of young people. But certainly at my clinic, I have sort of 16-year-olds right up to about 2 weeks ago, a 99-year-old at the clinic. So, you know, we cover a wide age group. I think the exciting thing about our guest today is that she specializes mostly in that younger group of people and would be regarded certainly nationally here as the UK as someone who would be a leading voice in that younger group of people with osteoporosis.
I'm really excited about today's interview, so let's get started. Well, listeners, we have a really wonderful guest with us today, somebody we wanted to have on the podcast for a really long time, Dr. Jenny Walsh. Dr. Walsh is a senior clinical lecturer in the Metabolic Bone Centre at the School of Medicine and Population Health in the University of Sheffield, which is a really world-renowned bone research institute and bone training centre. Welcome, Jenny.
Welcome, Jenny. We're really delighted to have you on the podcast.
Thank you both. I'm really pleased to be asked and very excited to be doing this.
That's great. I maybe sort of kick things off. People often think of osteoporosis as a condition that affects older people. But as you and I know, it does affect younger people as well. So could you give us some sort of general idea how common osteoporosis is in younger people? And probably a related question, how common fragility fractures are in younger people?
Yeah, sure. So I think the first thing is I'm going to be a bit awkward about the use of the word osteoporosis in young people. I generally prefer to talk about people with low bone density because the definition of osteoporosis includes deterioration in bone structure. And for me, deterioration kind of implies an aging process to a bone which is already grown and developed. Whereas in younger people, we're often talking about bones which are still in development or only just developed. So I think trying not to think about the kind of processes of osteoporosis as we think about them in older adults is an important differentiation in this group. And so I think that's sort of relates to your question about sort of how we think about osteoporosis in this group. Then if low bone density in young adults is reasonably common, and it can be because of a range of causes, really, either specific inherited disorders or because of concomitant illnesses which often affect children and young people, or the treatment of those illnesses, so including things like steroids or cancer treatment. But there are a group of young people who just have low bone density and we never really find an underlying cause, and it's probably sort of a mixture of sort of, you know, the multifactorial genetics they've inherited from both parents. But there does seem to be a group of young people that do have something that looks a lot like osteoporosis in older people, and we can't really find a cause for it. there's a clearly defined, well-recognized peak of fractures in kind of teenagers. And this happens in the normal, healthy population, because as bones are growing in puberty, particularly around the time of peak height velocity, and, you know, you'll all recognize this from your own kids or kids that you know, there's that age where kids just suddenly sort of shoot up in early puberty. And when they're doing that, their bones grow in length and size first, and then secondarily fill in, strengthen and build their structure. So there's this kind of window when the bones have grown but aren't yet strong enough, where bones are a little bit vulnerable. And that age of kind of peak height velocity tends to correspond a little bit with peak stupid in teenage as well, you know, of the age of fighting with your siblings and falling off your bicycle and pushing each other off stuff. So there's a sort of clear peak of bone fragility in normal teenagers, but there are a number of things that can cause low bone density and increased fracture risk in young adults for other reasons as well.
For the benefit of the tape, David was giving that a big thumbs up. So given then that we should be talking about low bone density in young people rather than a disease, osteoporosis, how do the ways in which you assess fracture risk in young people compare to the way in which you would maybe assess a fracture risk in an older person?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that, you know, the same principles apply. Bone density measured by DEXA does associate with fracture risk in young adults. But there are a few differences in how we use bone density and how we interpret it. And firstly, in younger adults, we shouldn't be thinking about T-scores, because T-scores are how we define osteoporosis in older adults. And a T-score is comparing your bone density to an average young adult. And so a T-score is really asking the question, kind of, how much bone do we think you've lost since you were a young adult? And so in a young adult, that's not really an appropriate question to ask. So we use the Z-score instead, which compares you to somebody of the same age and same gender. So it's asking, you know, is your bone density different than we would expect given your age and your gender? The bone mineral density by DEXA does associate with fracture risk in young people, but the gradient is much, much shallower than it is in older adults. And so if you draw a graph of bone density and fracture risk for different ages, in older people, as bone density decreases, fracture risk increases quite steeply. But in younger adults, the increase in fractures with decreasing bone density is much less. And so it's really important to understand that even with low bone density in young adults, their absolute fracture risk isn't as high as it would be in an older adult. And something else I'm going to say that's kind of really important is that fracs hasn't been validated in people under the age of 40. So we shouldn't be using fracs in under 40-year-olds. So when we're thinking about the bone density and how that associates with fracture risk, it's really important to separate out the concepts of relative risk and absolute risk. So a 25-year-old with low bone density might have 10 times the fracture risk of an average 25-year-old with normal bone density, but that's still going to be 10 times nearly nothing. So although their relative risk is higher, their absolute risk is still really not that high. And I think that's a really important thing to try to understand and bearing in mind when we're making judgments about fracture risk on bone density. And then in the same way we would of a person of any age, we'd think about their bone density, but we'd also think about the context of their clinical risk factors and the other underlying factors that increase their fracture risk, their risk of injury, their risk of falls. In the same way that we think of vertebral fractures in older adults as being really, really important predictors of future fracture risk, that holds true in young adults as well. And, you know, we'll talk a bit about sort of using pharmacological treatment in younger adults, but vertebral fractures is one of the few things that might nudge me towards using pharmacological treatments in young adults, because it's such an important indicator of high risk.
I'm very excited to get on to talking about using pharmacological treatment, or perhaps not using pharmacological treatment in young adults. Just to pick up on your point about, should we use the term osteoporosis for an 85-year-old and a 25-year-old? And I have to say, yeah, I agree with that a lot. I think they are quite sort of different conditions, really, or the way we should think about them are quite different conditions. Do you think using the term osteoporosis, because a 20-year-old or 25-year-old may have been told after their DEXA scan or told by their GP that you have osteoporosis, do you find that's unhelpful?
I think because osteoporosis is the word that a lot of people sort of understand and recognise, that most people would know that that means that your bones are weaker and more likely to break. It's not a bad word to try and explain things to people, but it's quite a frightening thing to say to somebody at that sort of age, because it is associated, you know, with older adults and very much that kind of older adult bone fragility. And it can really terrify people that come to then see you and say, you know, am I going to end up with spine fractures and hip fractures? And is that what we're talking about when I'm 25 or 30? And for most people, that's not really the case. So I think it's a word that a lot of people understand. And so I understand why it's used to try and explain the results of bone density measurements and bone fragility. But I think it is a word we need to use a little bit carefully.
And as a follow-on from that, do you find yourself trying to explain to a lot of younger people perhaps why they shouldn't be on pharmacological treatment more than trying to persuade them to take pharmacological treatment? Do you see young people have perhaps been started on a bisphosphonate by the GP age 20 who you're stopping it again?
Yeah, that does sometimes happen. And it's because low bone density in young people is often... it's quite individual, because often there will be an underlying cause, or they're definitely sort of perhaps a less uniform group than osteoporosis in older adults. It's really individual between patients as to kind of their perception of risk and how keen they are to take treatment because they're frightened of the risk, or whether they're reluctant to take treatment because they're variably sensibly thinking, you know, I'm young and I don't really want to be committing myself to something that could be years and years of treatment. But certainly if someone has been started on treatment, perhaps by somebody who sees the bone density result and associates that with the risk of somebody a bit older, I think there is an important conversation to be had about trying to explain that idea of sort of the absolute risk in younger people, and if we don't think that they really need to be on treatment, having an open conversation about, you know, what the treatment, the fact that it might not really be buying them any benefit right here, right now, and there may not be such a strong case for them to be on treatment.
What are the treatment guidelines for managing young people with low bone mineral density?
So there aren't really any specific guidelines for young people. And I think that's partly because of the heterogeneity of the group. And so the circumstances are very different for different groups. But I think there are some really sensible general principles that can be applied to all young adults. And so that's look for underlying causes of low bone density. And there are data to show that in younger adults, it's more likely that there is an additional underlying cause than in an older adult with low bone density and fractures. And then give the same lifestyle advice that we would give to anybody around maintaining a good dietary calcium intake, being physically active, smoking cessation, alcohol moderation. And then generally reserving pharmacological treatment for the people who are at really high risk right now. And that's either because they're having ongoing fractures, particularly vertebral fractures, or that you can see that their bone density is decreasing over time and you need to do something about that.
And what kind of treatments do you give the patients? Is it the same treatments that you might give an older person who has osteoporosis?
That's where things get quite difficult, because none of the treatments we use for osteoporosis are really licensed for use in younger people. There's a lack of evidence to guide treatment. Most of what we have is studies in small numbers of people. So if I do need to use treatment in a younger adult, my first line generally would be a bisphosphonate, on the grounds that we've been using them for a really long time. We understand them really well. We know what the risks and benefits are, but it's always important to have a conversation with the young person about the fact that this is, you know, out with the usual use of the drug, and that they understand that. And particularly with young women, there's a really important conversation to be had around the use of pharmacological agents, including bisphosphonates, in pregnancy, and making sure that they understand that they shouldn't be getting pregnant while they're using a bone drug, and that they're using reliable contraception.
I mean, we focus understandably on that concept that you have peak bone mineral density or peak bone mass when you're 25, and we tell students that, and we often explain that to patients as well. Can you actually improve your peak bone mass then if you're 26 or 27 or 30 if you can address the underlying problem, or is 25 simply a cutoff and that's it, you can't do any better?
You definitely can make improvements beyond the age of 25. And peak bone mass is not a single entity. So different skeletal sites reach peak bone mass at different ages. And so probably your hip is actually at its peak bone mass for a woman actually by about age 19, 20, whereas your vertebrae are still developing bone structure and gaining bone density probably a bit later, sort of 25 or beyond. So, and we see that as well when we see people that have had negative influences on their bone during development. So kind of the age at which something starts to affect your bones affects kind of the pattern of where you'll have low bone density. So although your bones are done maturing, usually by the age of about 25 in men and in women, there is evidence that those kind of lifestyle interventions, physical activity, calcium and vitamin D, smoking cessation, do still cause small increases in bone density. And they're increases in the sort of magnitude of, you know, a couple of percent. But a bisphosphonate only increases bone density in most people by about 5%. And that's associated with a really significant decrease in fracture risk. So even sort of small changes of a few percent due to lifestyle changes are really meaningful in terms of getting bone in the bank. And, you know, we talk to young adults a lot about doing what they can now to get their bones as healthy as possible and do their future self a favour. And, you know, when you're, you know, 20, 25, the prospect that one day you will be 40 is utterly inconceivable. But trying to kind of talk to people about the idea of kind of, yeah, what you get in the bank now is, you know, a reserve that you will have, your future self will thank you for.
That's interesting. That I think there's been a lot of talk lately about how can we engage young people more in their bone health to try and encourage them to take positive steps so that they're going to maintain that health throughout their lives. And I suppose with this group of patients, young people with low bone mineral density, you're really at the sharp end of those discussions. Speaking about the lifestyle changes, do people take kind of more drastic action? Do they change the way that they live, like, you know, avoid adventure sports or skiing or things like that?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. And this is a conversation I often have with patients. And it's about finding that balance of risk. And so generally, you know, people with very low bone density, particularly people with vertebral fractures, I would discourage from activities that really put their spine at risk. So things like horse riding, trampolining, bungee jumping. But there is a balance to be struck between doing the things that make you really happy and keep you fit and healthy, and accepting that you're probably a bit more at risk of fracturing if you have an injury than someone with normal bone density. But it's about striking the balance. And so I would really try not to make people fearful that they can't go out and live their lives, but taking a few sensible precautions is kind of the route that I would take. And, you know, I do have patients who have low bone density and are at quite high risk, but they have things that are really, really important to them that they really, really want to keep doing. So my job is to advise and help them think about the risk.
A lot of people have been getting in touch with us ever since we started the podcast to ask about the effect of eating disorders on bone. And whenever we put out a call on social media, has anybody got any things we would like to discuss? That is a topic that always, always comes up. So we wanted to ask you a few questions about that, if we may. What kind of effect do eating disorders have on bone health? And how can you manage the health of people living with a eating disorder?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And similarly, you know, generally often when I give talks, this is the question that people really want to ask, because it's complicated and it's a real challenge for patients with eating disorders. It is well documented that people with eating disorders do have lower bone density, and that they do have a higher risk of fractures. And there was a really nice paper in JBMR this year with quite a long duration of follow-up to 40 years of people with eating disorders, demonstrating that they do have an increased fracture risk. And it's a complicated bone disease because there are so many factors that are feeding in. So we tend to think about, you know, the effects of low body weight. And we know that, you know, the amount of weight loading on your bones has an effect on your bone density and your bone strength. And then there are the nutritional factors around people eating quite restricted diets. But they're not the only factors acting. We need to think about all the, I'm an endocrinologist by training, so obviously this is all going to be about the endocrinology. But people with eating disorders have low sex steroids, low estrogen and low testosterone. And obviously we know that that has negative effects on bone. But people with eating disorders also have high levels of cortisol because of the kind of chronic stress reaction. And so that has effects on bone in the same way, to a lesser magnitude, but at the same way that taking steroids does, that it increases bone resorption and decreases bone formation. And people with eating disorders and low body weight also have low levels of IGF-1. Which is an important factor for bone health, especially in young adults. And so there are all of these different factors feeding into the low bone density. And that's why often when people have done studies looking at interventions for bone health in eating disorders, they're not very successful, because they only really tackle one aspect of this kind of multifactorial bone disease. So for example, in trials of combined oral contraceptives, taking the pill, that's not very successful. And that's probably because it sort of resolves some of the issues around the low estrogen, but it makes the low IGF-1 worse. So you're kind of improving one of the factors, but making another one worse. And so that's why some of the intervention trials haven't really shown much benefit, because you need to think about sort of complexity of the effects on bone rather than just one factor.
Well, we've talked before in other episodes of this about the importance of exercise for bone, and actually importance of exercise in young people for bone and building bone. Obviously, with an eating disorder, there's a group of patients there who will over-exercise and will use that to control their weight. Now, if you get, let's say, the menstrual cycle sorted out and there's an improvement maybe in the relationship with food and some weight gain and other things are going well, How do you fit exercise into that? Because, as I say, people will sometimes have a bad relationship with exercise in the sense that they will use it to gain weight or to keep weight down. But we want people to exercise because it's good for their bones.
Yeah, this is a really tricky issue, as you say. You know, weight-bearing activity and resistance activity is really important in maintaining your bone health. But some people with restrictive eating disorders do use exercise as a way of managing their weight and keeping their weight down. So I think this is something that needs to be done really carefully in combination with the person's eating disorder team. And so that kind of you set some clear parameters and a clear plan for what's an appropriate level of physical activity for that person, and do that, you know, in conversation with the patient and with their wider team.
It is quite a multidisciplinary approach. You've sort of touched on that on a number of occasions there.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's the key to looking after people with complex multifactorial disease. You know, you need a team of people with the right expertise working together and working with the patient.
And this affects young men as well as young women. I mean, I think we automatically maybe think of young women with eating disorders, but, you know, could you put even a figure, what percentage of eating disorders, or in terms of low bone mineral density, what percentage of young men we're looking at here? And are we missing young men, do you think, because we're not thinking about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think young men with eating disorders get missed. I think, you know, probably about 10% of people with eating disorders are men. And that's, I would guess, probably a bit of an underestimate, because they tend to have different features as part of their eating disorder, which might go a bit unrecognised. And I think probably as healthcare professionals, spotting the signs of people who might have eating disorders and asking them whether that might be something that they recognise and need help with, we're probably a bit blind to eating disorders in men. And so I think probably we don't do a very good job of spotting the things that might indicate an eating disorder and having that conversation with men. So I think they are probably, yeah, an under-recognised and underserved group. And there are some data showing that, you know, the effects on bone density in men and the effects on fracture risk are pretty similar to women with eating disorders. So their bone health does need to be considered.
When it comes to the management of patients with an eating disorder, how do you address the bone health issue? Do you have to work with patients first to try and resolve the eating problems before then also trying to work on the bone health? Or do you find that if you can resolve the eating problems, then the bone will fix and repair and heal?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the key is addressing the underlying eating disorder. And if that can be improved and with improvements in body weight and particularly restoration of spontaneous menses, then that's the key to improving bone health. And that's really easy to say as the bone doctor, isn't it? Because you just kind of say to the eating disorders team and the patient kind of, well, you know, just sort out the eating disorder and the bones will get better. But obviously, in some people, eating disorders are chronic and you need to think about what you do to manage the bone health in patients whose eating disorders aren't improving and aren't resolving if they're at high risk. So certainly calcium and vitamin D supplementation, making sure that you can address that. And most patients with eating disorders will accept calcium and vitamin D supplementation. Talking about the other general lifestyle things around, you know, smoking, alcohol, all of that stuff. And then, yeah, very occasionally in people who are at high risk, then I might consider using a bone drug. In very young women with eating disorders, so kind of women in their teens, there is quite good evidence for the use of transdermal estrogen to improve their bone density. Again, you know, really small studies in these groups. But because using estrogen patches, transdermal estrogen, it doesn't have the effect on to lower IGF-1 that taking a pill does. And in the available evidence, young women with eating disorders given transdermal estrogen do actually improve their bone density at the same sort of rate as comparable women of the same age without an eating disorder. So it does seem to be really effective in that group. In women past the age of peak bone mass, there is small study evidence that resedronate can improve bone density. And when I say small study, I mean studies of like, you know, 30 people. And there is a more recent study using denosumab, which did show some improvement in spine bone density in women of average age of about 29. But again, you know, small studies, early days. And obviously, you know, using denosumab in this group raises all sorts of other questions about kind of how long you would use it for, how you would stop it, and complexities around that.
One of the things comes up again and again in our podcast is this concept of bone quality as well as bone quantity. And certainly in terms of eating disorder patients, you know, we've talked just about bone mass and bone density. I've seen patients who have maybe, do you ever recover entirely from an eating disorder, have done a lot better and are maybe middle-aged and are doing better with it? They still seem to be at quite a high risk of fracture. And I wonder about the quality of the bone, if you've had chronic malnutrition and you know, poor exposure to important nutrients at a crucial age for bone development. Do you think quality is an issue as well, even if you sort out the quantity of bone? And is that reversible as you get older?
Yeah, I think that's what we know a lot less about. There have been some studies using high-resolution PQCT in women with eating disorders to describe kind of the change in the bone microstructure. And those studies have demonstrated that there is poorer microstructure within the bone. So the cortex is thinner, the cortex is more porous, the trabecular density is lower and the trabecular connectivity is less good. So all of those things that kind of feed into the mechanical strength of the bone, independent of the bone density, are impaired in people with anorexia nervosa. But I think what we don't know really is, yeah, how much of that recovers when the eating disorder is treated and improved. And I think you may well be right that even though we see improvements in bone density, some of those kind of microstructural factors and other bone quality factors might continue to be impaired and contribute to an increased fracture risk.
Jenny, the studies that you've been talking about where people have tested the bone medicines in people with an eating disorder do sound very small. Why is that? Is it that our community hasn't put enough emphasis on developing studies like that? Or is it that it is such a small number of people that are affected that it's difficult to deliver the trials?
Probably a little bit of both. I think obviously people with eating disorders have got quite complex health concerns. They've got a lot of interventions going on, a lot of healthcare professionals, and then kind of asking them to engage on top of that with research and trials, particularly drug trials, when people are a little bit, you know, wary of anything that might interact with their eating disorder and their weight. So I think it's a challenge to do big number trials in people with eating disorders because they have got a lot going on and understandably are a bit reluctant to sign up for research. And then sort of maintaining people within the trials and retention is difficult. So I think, yeah, probably a little bit of both, probably a little bit of wariness that it's difficult to do the trials and the trials are a bit difficult to do in this patient group.
And with younger patients, there's always that low risk of fracture in the background as well, isn't there? That you know, it's harder to prove reduced fracture risk, perhaps unless in this group you're following up for 20 or 30 years. But of course, that's clearly difficult to do as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Jenny, one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the podcast is because I've seen you speak a lot of events around the bone community. I remember the first time I ever saw you give a talk, it was about using bone turnover markers. And I got there early and sat down in the front row. And I remember you gave an absolutely amazing talk, crystal clear all of the way through, talked about bone markers and how they can be used in clinical practice. And since then, I've seen you many times, recently the ROS, where you gave a really clear talk there. It's clear that you devote a lot of time and a lot of effort to the bone community. not just in your clinical practice, but outside as well. Where do you find the drive to put so much love and time into your work?
Oh, thank you. I think it's a combination of the fact that I genuinely find these subjects really interesting. You know, my medical students will tell you that, you know, if anybody asks me a question of anything to do with an aspect of bone health, you know, they're in for a long answer. I really remember when we're teaching online a lot, you know, during the pandemic, and I was teaching my medical students, and my partner was just passing through the room behind me at the point one of the medical students asked a question about bone turnover markers. And my partner just started shaking his head in a kind of, oh, you're going to get more of an answer than you bargained for here. I think I find bones really interesting to work with because of the kind of multidisciplinary nature of the science, that you need to understand the biology and the chemistry, but you also need to understand bones as a physical object. So you need to understand the physics and the material science. And, you know, a few years ago, I was working with the in silico engineers trying to build experimental models of bones that could be passed into the Virtual Physiological Human project. And so that kind of working with people from so many disciplines, I find really exciting, because it means you spend all your time with really interested, engaged people who fuel your own enthusiasm. And then the other aspect is, you know, I genuinely enjoy working with this patient group of particularly, you know, young adults, and the young adults I see, whether they are people with inherited bone disorders like osteogenesis imperfecta, or whether they are people who've had other health problems affect their bone, or people that I see because they've had bone problems because they're elite sports people. And it's just a really interesting group of people to spend time with. And being a young adult is really difficult as well. You know, there's a lot going on in people's lives at that age. And then having health problems layered on top of that, I think is really a lot to deal with. So yeah, I think it sort of is twofold: genuine nerd enthusiasm for the subject, and also a lot of empathy for these patients, and really wanting to do what I can to make things work a bit better for them as individual patients, but sort of as a group as well, through kind of research and you know, working with national groups and things like that.
It really comes across that you love what you do. What was the spark that set you off down this route?
When I was a third year medical student, I did my very first placement with endocrinology. And their enthusiasm for the subject and was so clear. And I think, you know, that has a big influence, isn't it? It's the people that you see along the way, and their enthusiasm is infectious. And I enjoyed the subject material as well. And sort of through that, I started to get interested in sort of puberty and young adult medicine. And so I did kind of clinics with teenagers who presented with problems of puberty and growth. And from there, I kind of started doing kind of clinics for cancer survivors who'd had sort of long-term consequences of their cancer treatment, and that kind of got me more interested in bone. And then from there I did that's sort of the route that got me here and kind of kept me going ever since, really.
That's amazing how different things could have been if you'd had a different placement.
If I'd worked with if my first placement had been with a really enthusiastic gastroenterologist, I could have had a very different life.
It's something I'm always conscious of with medical students. You know, no matter how grumpy you're feeling and how bad a day you're having, you have to let the actual basic enthusiasm for what we do shine through, I think, because, you know, you do remember that, don't you? People you worked with when you were younger, who, despite the fact they seem terribly old and academic and all the rest of it, they still seem to enjoy what they were doing. And yeah, I think most of us hopefully still do enjoy what we're doing.
Yeah, it's a really privileged thing that we get to do, isn't it?
You know, if you're wondering why we didn't ask you anything about Duchenne muscular dystrophy and young people, young people with that, we had Jared Wong on a couple of episodes ago talking all about that, because that's something that you and I very recently have been on a committee talking about. So, you know, there are obviously many other aspects of osteoporosis in young people we just haven't had time to touch on. But, you know, we'll maybe get you on again and get you to talk about other things as well.
And Jared is doing really, really good work to pull together some coherence of practice and clinical guidelines for that group of patients. He's doing great work with that.
I think it's nice for our listeners to know, because we've had lots of guests on over the last few series, but we do actually all sort of meet up in different environments and work and chat together as well, and sort of know each other outside the podcast, which I think is nice.
And important for recruiting people onto the podcast as well.
Absolutely.
Jenny, it's been an absolute delight talking to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to have the opportunity to go on about the subjects that I'm enthusiastic about. So thank you very much. It's always lovely to talk to the two of you.
It's always such great fun talking about bones, isn't it?
David, I really enjoyed the interview today. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, but you know, my first takeaway from these things is always that I'm sorry we can't go on for longer. I can't believe the time runs so quickly. I think one of the things Jenny said that has always struck me is even using the term osteoporosis for younger people, and how she prefers to say to a young person, you've got low bone mineral density, and then discuss the actual fracture risk and how it can be managed. And I think that's useful, because sometimes using the term osteoporosis doesn't, you know, it can be helpful, but it also can scare people, and they can believe that they must get strong drugs immediately. So in some ways, that's given me some reassurance and confirmation that you know, I should probably be just talking about low bone mineral density for younger people. I think that's good. I think that's a good learning point in general. I think the other thing, just you can see how complex an area this is. When you see low bone mineral density in a younger person, you know, one size does not fit all. There are many different potential causes. There are many potential different managements. And of course, as Jenny mentioned, pretty much all of the drugs we use, if we do use them in young people, they're not licensed, and we're using them sort of on first principles or on the basis that they help others, but there's really very few or no significant large studies showing the benefits of these drugs. So again, emphasizing the importance of talking to the patients about what we're trying to achieve, getting the patients on board, finding out about what their values and concerns are, and sort of making a joint decision. And I think it's particularly important that a younger person understands, if we are going for one of these stronger drugs, what we're actually trying to achieve. You know, that conversation can be a bit easier in a 75-year-old who's fractured a hip. It can be more complex in a 21-year-old who maybe hasn't had a fracture, but who has a lot of other complex things going on. So, just to be generally inspired by how enthusiastic and knowledgeable Jenny is on the subject. And what about your takeaways?
I think mine were quite similar. So impressed by the depth and breadth of Jenny's knowledge about our subject area. For example, even the little things like peak bone mass. I've always understood peak bone mass to develop sometime around about 25 to mid 30s. I never knew that the peak bone mass would develop in different parts of the body at different times, and I didn't know that, at least in women, as Jenny said, that peak bone mass develops in the hip before it does in the vertebrae. I was very impressed by the way Jenny talked about her patients and the way that she talks and communicates with the patients. I guess the same goes for you. It must be very difficult to work with young people who suddenly get this bolt out of the blue that they have low bone mineral density and they might have a fracture. As a young person, that's probably the last thing that you would think you're going to get told. It seems like Jenny has a really great love for her patients and a great love for the field, as we said in the podcast, and I'm so impressed by that. It makes me inspired, and it makes me want to do more, which I really like. And I think overall, my takeaway from this whole podcast is that it helps me to keep going because it always keeps me inspired and motivated, you know?
I mean, I hope the podcast, I hope it inspires those other healthcare professionals and scientists who are working in the field to do what they do with more, you know, more determination. I hope it inspires patients as well who are listening to know that, you know, there's a lot of work going on and that those people who are involved, both seeing them in the clinic and seeing them in the surgery and seeing them in the gymnasium, but also those of us who are involved, like you, you know, in the laboratory doing work, that, you know, we're continuing to work behind the scenes, that we think about what we do, that we reflect on it, and that, you know, we're all trying to do a better job if we can.
Yeah. Working together to share best practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, listeners, we hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Thanks very much for listening, and hopefully we'll have another episode up for you very soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.